You may not be familiar with the name Truett Cathy, but you probably are familiar with the restaurant that he started. Every time we go to Iowa to see our granddaughter, I have to eat there at least once. In 1946, Cathy opened a restaurant south of Atlanta named the Dwarf Grill. And his business grew over the years by serving up quality food and friendly service 24 hours a day, 6 days a week. In the mid-60s, his business really took off. Truett pioneered fast food in malls by opening up the first Chick-fil-A in an Atlanta mall. People loved his food. And Mr. Cathy was a devout Christian. He believed Sunday should be treated as the Sabbath. Consequently, company policy dictated that all Chick-fil-A restaurants be closed every Sunday. Despite serving food one less day a week than his competitors, his company continued to grow. By the late 70s, Chick-fil-A sales topped $100 million a year. But the economic recession of the early 80s challenged Cathy's no Sunday policy. Sales declined. Other fast food restaurants began selling chicken sandwiches. The cost of raw materials soared. And the company at that time was carrying a heavy debt. And the pressure was on for them to generate more revenue. If Chick-fil-A opened on Sundays, they would increase their annual revenue by 16%. So Cathy called a leadership retreat with his executive team. And they strategized how to increase revenue. But most importantly, they rededicated the company to God. They would not violate their conscience by opening on Sunday, no matter what. At that time, they created a new mission statement, which still directs the company today. The mission of Chick-fil-A is to glorify God by being faithful steward of all that is entrusted to us and to have a positive influence on all who come in contact with Chick-fil-A. Most recently, Chick-fil-A received backlash for their commitment to a biblical view of gender and marriage. But despite difficulties, despite pressure to compromise, Chick-fil-A has remained true to Cathy's biblical convictions. Today, the company has over 3,000 stores, and in 2025, it sold nearly $24 billion worth of chicken and waffle fries. So what does it take to live as a Christian today? On the corporate level, it takes a rock-solid conviction to obedience to God, which will not be swayed by outrage or mockery. But what about in our personal lives? It still takes a rock-solid conviction to obedience, no matter how much pressure we receive to compromise holiness. We live in a culture and a world which hates God. I do not mean that American culture hates God in the same way that Nebuchadnezzar in the Babylonian culture did. The contemporary hatred of God is far less violent, but the unsaved American world still despises God. Colossians chapter 1 says that before salvation, all are enemies against God. And America is shaped by these God-enemies, God-hating ideals and goals and desires. This culture exerts a great overt and subtle pressure to conform Christians to its secular ideologies. And public mockery of Christianity, in-your-face displays of wickedness, are attempts to coerce Christians to forsake righteousness. But I would say those overt displays are not the most common. But there are many more effective and more frequently employed means, very subtle means, to seek to sway the Christian to disobey God. Nobody likes to be treated as an outsider. Nobody wants to be dismissed as failing to keep up with the times, or just to be politely ignored. And the unspoken assumption in most social groups is that if you do not conform to our views on these particular subjects, then you will not be one of us. Younger family members will roll their eyes at what you see, what you say. Co-workers will exclude you from conversations and decisions. Neighbors will tell one another that you're odd or a killjoy or a religious nut. And these relational pressures seek to turn us away from complete obedience to God. We need great wisdom to navigate the pressures and the temptations of this world without shipwrecking ourselves on sin. The book of Daniel shows us how four men lived wisely in a world which hates God. Now, the book of Daniel is not about how to live as Christians in a pagan world. That's not why it was written. It was written to teach and to show the sovereignty of God over everything. So the events and the visions recorded showed the conquering Babylonians and the conquered Hebrews that Jehovah is still in charge of all things. The Most High rules slaves, kings, and all the world. He rules kingdoms, and he rules all world history. And the four godly men in this book lived as if God truly rules all. And so even though it is not the reason the book was written, in living this way, these four men illustrate for us how to live as if God rules 21st century America. And so this morning, we are going to go back and resurvey Daniel 1 and Daniel 3 to consider the example of these men that we might learn from them how to properly direct their lives. So normally, when I preach a passage, I read the scripture we'll be discussing, explain what the passage is teaching, and then apply the passage to our life. And so generally, the explanation takes the most time because if we don't know what a passage says, we can't know how it applies to our lives. This morning, I'm going to do far less explanation than usual. Over the last several weeks, we have gone through these first three chapters. I've explained much of them. And so I'm assuming that the majority of you have a working understanding of what's happening in Daniel 1, 2, and 3. So what I'm going to do today is just really spend most of the time applying these truths to our lives. Before we delve into the particulars, I want to give you just a quick overview. The book of Daniel divides neatly into two sections. The first six chapters focus on the events from the lives of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. The second six chapters focus on God's revelation of the future through visions and the explanation of those visions. The first six chapters of Daniel also divide very neatly into two parts. So the first three chapters have themes which are echoed in the next three. In chapter one, we read of the Hebrews humbled by God and then exalted by him. In chapter four, we read of Nebuchadnezzar humbled by God and then exalted by him. In chapter 2, we read of God's revelation of the future to the king of Babylon. And in chapter 5, we read of God's revelation of the immediate future to the king of Babylon. In chapter 3, we read of God's deliverance of his faithful servants from certain death. In chapter 6, we read of God's deliverance of his faithful servant from certain death. And the structure here in Daniel, it serves to emphasize that God is in complete control of all people, all circumstances, and all kingdoms. And God's sovereignty, his control of all things, should change how we live our lives. This sovereignty of God, I know when we discuss it, it's a complex subject. And it leaves many struggling to understand how it all works. But it is not taught in the Bible to mystify us. It's not taught in the Bible only to appeal to the intellects of deep thinkers. The sovereignty of God is deeply practical. If we believe God is truly sovereign, our daily lives will be changed. So when you gather with your family for a holiday, and your niece brings her girlfriend with her, the sovereignty of God shapes your response to them. When your boss wants you to lie about a decision the company made, the sovereignty of God directs your speech. When your neighbor invites you over to what you know will be a drunken party, the sovereignty of God directs your answer. These first three chapters of Daniel show us that the assurance God is sovereign, it teaches us to live wisely in this world. A wise life is consecrated to holiness and is committed to obedience, no matter what the cost. In Daniel chapter 1, we see the Hebrews' consecration to holiness. There in verse 8, Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine with which he drank. So as I said, when we first looked at this passage, we don't know what it was about the king's food which would defile the Hebrews. We'd like to know, but ultimately it's irrelevant. The food would defile, therefore the Hebrews purposed not to eat it. And they resisted great pressure to maintain their purity before God. And it seems as if the Hebrews saw this particular temptation coming. That the way it's worded seems to suggest that they had made this decision before the food was offered to them, and they determined they would not eat of it. So a necessary first step as we think about maintaining holiness is to look ahead and see what temptations may be coming. Now, I know we cannot see all possible temptations, and we certainly don't need to lay awake at night trying to guess what temptations we may face the next day. But on the other hand, we can often predict likely temptations. You go to the same place to work every day. You go to the same place to shop or the same place to eat. You hang around with the same people in your neighborhood. You have an idea of what temptations are coming. So if you know a temptation is coming, make reasonable plans to refuse to yield. Start with absolute commitment to holiness. That's where it starts, a purpose to not defile themselves. Start there with a bedrock conviction, I am going to obey God. And then take the practical steps to avoid the temptation, if possible. Work to prevent even the opportunity for temptation. So pray, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. 1 Peter instructs us to be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. So take practical steps to be on guard against temptation. If, for example, if you're online, you know you are going to be tempted to view illicit material. Somebody is going to throw something in your face at some point. You know you're going to be tempted to write something unkind. You might be tempted to be overwhelmed with worry or anger or fear because of the latest political news or somebody's response to it. You know those temptations are coming, so plan now and make good plans to address them. You may need to put ad blockers and filters on your internet browser. You should not just scroll or click aimlessly. So go online when you have a specific purpose. And when you're going online and you're posting something, you may need to wait 10 seconds before you do so that you reread what you wrote. And you pray about your words before you hit send. You may need to avoid certain news sites or certain people. You may need to go back and intentionally begin to click on good things to retrain the algorithms that are pumping you in a particular kind of content. Memorize a couple key verses which will direct your heart, your mind, your eyes, and actions when you're tempted. Make a specific and practical plan to avoid the temptation, to minimize its temptiveness, and to refuse to succumb to the temptation. And when Daniel here was confronted with this opportunity to sin, he also responded with righteousness and gentleness. He does not resort to unholy means to preserve his commitment to holiness. So when the king's food was brought to them, Daniel did not yell and scream. He did not throw the plate on the ground and kick over the tables. Daniel 1 verse 8, it says that he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Daniel approached the situation with grace. He made a clear request with humility and meekness. He did not confuse loudness and bombast with a commitment to holiness. Their quiet request did not mean that they were weak and ready to yield. They were bold, absolutely unmovable in their obedience, while making a gracious request. And you know the story, their request was initially rejected by the chief of the eunuchs. Daniel there did not lose his temper. He didn't give up. He did not respond to that in sin. Instead, he approached the problem from a different direction. He went then to the one directly responsible for the care of him and his friends. And he offered a reasonable solution to their problem. And so in verses 12 and 13, Daniel said, "Please test your servants for 10 days and let them give us vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be examined before you in the appearance of the young men who eat the portion of the king's delicacies. And as you see fit, so deal with your servants." So Daniel's commitment to holiness here does not lead him to being harsh or even to making demands, or in this particular case, even giving an outright refusal. Now, in some situations, an outright refusal, like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, when they were commanded to bow before the idol, they completely refused. That was appropriate. But when there's no other option but disobedience to God, the Christian should refuse in no uncertain terms. But a commitment to holiness also permits and seeks for reasonable means to achieve the goals of others. You notice what he did there. He said he knew what the chief of the eunuchs wanted. He knew what Nebuchadnezzar was wanting. And he provided a solution to that problem that allowed them to get what they wanted while they remained holy. You can seek reasonable means, holy means, to achieve the goals of others without compromising obedience to God. So for example, if you learn that you have a homosexual family member, you cannot approve or support their choice. However, you don't need to lambast them the first time you see them. You do not even necessarily need to refuse all contact with them. You don't need to send an email to everybody in the family decrying the evil that they are committing. You can be civil, kind, and gracious without affirming their sin. So, for example, you can share a meal with them, but you cannot let them share a bed in your house. You can affirm your love for them, but you cannot affirm their sexual identity. There is a reasonable and a gracious approach that is both holy and kind. Now skip over to chapter 3. I had hoped to draw principles from each of the first three chapters of this book, but time really doesn't allow me to examine the second chapter. In the third chapter, though, we see a commitment to obey God no matter the cost. Famously, we know Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were not going to bow before the king's idol. They would die before they disobeyed. They had already settled in their minds that they would obey God. And so in verse 18, they say to Nebuchadnezzar, "Let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up." When the ultimate pressure was put on them, they absolutely refused to sin. They were committed to holiness to God. People say that everyone has their price. I wonder what it would take to persuade you to disobey God. If the boss demands you tell a lie or lose your job, would you be willing to be fired rather than disobey a God? If not attending the neighbor's party means you'll be ostracized and ignored in the neighborhood, are you willing to be an outcast rather than disobey God? If your family members insist that you support their sin or they will never speak to you again, are you willing to lose that relationship rather than disobey God? At times there is a lot of social, financial, or personal pressure that is put on us to disobey God. And in that pressure begins to be arguments to insinuate that we're overreacting. The sin is not that big a deal. Or some will say, well, you're just being holier than thou. Or maybe you're being standoffish and unfriendly. Satan will whisper, it's better to commit one sin than to lose your job or to give up an important relationship. I mean, the devil will absolutely tell you, if you offend that person, you won't have an opportunity to minister to them later. So you better not offend them. There will be times where you wonder, what will happen to my retirement, to my dreams, to my friendships if I obey God? There'll be times where you wonder what happens to my ability to pay my mortgage or to heat my house or to put food on the table if I obey God. This pressure to disobey God can often be intense, and it comes from a variety of directions. And we must be absolutely committed to obedience in all things, that we will have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, that we will simply obey. Now, I am not going to tell you that if you obey God, you will never sacrifice anything or you will never suffer. You will not always be delivered from the fiery trial. Remember Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's answer here. They said that not only they will not obey, they also said that even if God does not deliver us, verse 18, but if he does not deliver us, we're still not going to obey your gods or serve your gods. We're still going to obey our God. God delivered them. But unfortunately, he won't always deliver us. And in fact, I would say it's rare that we are delivered from all of the negative consequences of our holiness, if I can say it like that. Ultimately, there are no negative consequences of holiness. But obedience to God will infuriate some people. Obedience to God will cause some people to avoid you, to whisper about you, and to look down their noses at you. Obedience to God has cost people their job. Obedience to God absolutely has cost family relationships. You might have to do without things that everybody else has. You might be out of step with the culture. You might have no friends in the neighborhood. You might wonder if God is going to provide. You may even get to the point of wondering, can I make it one more day? There will be times where you question if obedience to God is worth all it cost. And I can absolutely assure you from scriptures in my own personal life that God will not fail to provide your every need. God will never fail to be your loving Father who directs all your circumstances for your eternal good and His eternal glory, so that what you gain now and in heaven when you obey God is worth far more than anything that you lose. And we like to overcomplicate this by adding in factors and counting up things that don't actually matter. What really is this question is, what do I gain in eternity? As Paul says, I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared to the glory which will be revealed in us. He says that this light affliction is but for a moment and is working a far more an exceeding weight of glory. Obedience to God is worth it, whatever the cost. But to maintain this obedience, there also has to be a clarity and a boldness in your refusal to sin. The three Hebrews here plainly, boldly told the king, we're not going to participate in your idolatry. We do not serve your gods. Period. You cannot hedge on sin. You can't hedge on the sinfulness of homosexuality. You cannot minimize the devastation and evil of drug abuse or drunkenness or immorality. You cannot explain away or rationalize deceit or other sin. You must be clear in your own heart with what is sinful. And when you are pressured to sin, you must clearly communicate your refusal to participate in it. To simply say, no, I'm not doing that. Now, this doesn't mean that you immediately and always denounce the sinfulness of every sin that comes before you. There are many times where you just quietly move away from the situation. Sometimes you can't. You just simply say no, and you don't need to say anything else. When author said different moments require different responses, we need the wisdom of when to speak, how to speak, and why to speak. Colossians chapter 4 says, walk in wisdom toward those who are outside, redeeming the time. Let your speech be always with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one. We need to exercise great wisdom to know what to say, when to say it. We need to speak holy, gracious, kind, and firm words, clear, unmoving words, so that... And here, in this example of the three Hebrews, when they're first commanded to bow, they do not begin to shout about the evils of idolatry. They simply refuse to bow. When the question was put to them directly, they gave a clear and uncompromising answer. And so when you discover a family member that's living in sin, you don't necessarily need to immediately decry their actions. You don't need to condemn them. You certainly do not need to announce that they are going to hell. If you are asked, be clear and honest. Say what God has said. Declare their sin to be forbidden by God and displeasing to Him. Don't be unkind. Certainly do not call them names. Be kind and tenderhearted. But you do not participate and you do not give unspoken approval of their sin. You speak the truth in love. Now we see verse 19, after Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego responded this way, Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury. When you are bold and are clear in obedience, when you speak the truth, don't be surprised if others become enraged, what you said. Even though they may be angry, you may know they're going to be angry, you cannot let their anger discourage you or dissuade you from speaking truth. But you also need to be warned and be ready. Sometimes, no matter how lovingly you tell a gay relative that you cannot support or affirm their sin, they're very likely to be infuriated. They may call you homophobic. They may treat your response as a personal attack against them. They may tell others that they have been shamed by you and traumatized by your rejection of who they are. If your boss insists you do something sinful on the job, he is not likely to thank you and applaud your integrity when you refuse to do it. He's likely to threaten your job. He might overlook you for promotion. He might try to hold back raises. He might give you the worst jobs. Do not be surprised when people become angry at your refusal to participate in their sin. But do not let that motivate you to participate in their sin. We need to walk wisely. That wisdom is consecrated to holiness, absolutely bold in its obedience. One of the words that the Old Testament uses for wisdom is also used in ancient literature of a ship's helmsman's task in dangerous waters. The skillful helmsman is able to steer a vessel through the reefs and other underwater dangers which would damage the ship. Now that use of the word, it doesn't fully define it, but it is my favorite illustration of wise living. The wise person possesses the skill to safely navigate through the obstacles of life. He will make the righteous choices which will steer him away from spiritual danger. He will make prudent choices which will steer him away from unnecessarily conflict. And he will move steadily and fearlessly through dangerous waters. The winds and tides of the world will seek to push him on to the shoals of sin, but he will steer against that raging tempest, and he will not shipwreck his life. He'll be holy. And Daniel and his friends acted with great, great wisdom in all things. They did not excuse or rationalize disobedience. They did not doubt or deny God. As a result, the end of chapter 1 tells us that they had more wisdom than all the king's men. They had the godly wisdom. They made the right choices when pressured to make the wrong ones. If you will learn the wisdom of these men, if you will learn God is truly sovereign over all of your life, you will have the fortitude and the skill to obey God in all things. Dietrich Bonhoeffer said, "Do and dare what is right, not swayed by the whim of the moment. Make up your mind and come out into the tempest of living."